mouth.
Word of 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 mouth.
Mouth.
I'd help with me, Miss Private, and we'll sail around the world. I will be off at an end.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Picture a young man or a woman wearing a vintage cardigan, heavy bangs for her, unruly beard for him. They sit cross-legged on a bed, bent over a moleskin journal. On the side table, a dog-eared copy of The Catcher in the Rye. A Belle and Sebastian record, on vinyl, plays in the background. Tired of writing, they pick up a ukulele, plucking a few notes here and there, while casually watching the Wes Anderson film, Moonrise Kingdom.
These are my books. I like stories with magic powers in them, either in kingdoms.
I'm exaggerating slightly to highlight the notion of twee, which author, playwright, and journalist Mark Spitz proposes is the most important cultural movement since hip-hop. His new book, Twee, The Gentle Revolution in Music, Books, Television, Fashion, and Film, outlines a broad aesthetic that encompasses everything from Anne Frank to Etsy. He says twee has made the jump from Brooklyn Underground to mainstream America and is here to tell us why. Mark Spitz, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
So what ties all these things together that I just mentioned as twee? What is it?
There's a couple of things that draw them together. One is a tether that connects to an idealized childhood. Twee has been described, not by myself, although I quote it in the book, as a revolt into childhood. And that's not saying that you're acting childish. It's more like you're idealizing the innocence of being a child, and you're trying to either recapture it or signal it to other people that you're perhaps less corrupt, less vulgar, less prone to what is increasingly a terrifying and a sort of cynical world.
So is there a distinction between twee and cute? You know, the kind of like cute Hello Kitty movement kind of thing?
No, I would wrap up cute in twee. I think it's a part of it. I write about Hello Kitty in the book. In the 80s in England, there was a movement, actually, a group of not officially connected, but the press lumped them all together, and they actually called the movement cutie, and they called it twee or twee pop or indie pop. It was right after punk, and it was bands that like weren't really comfortable spiking their hair and were a little bit more interested in going on stage with Bedhead and the cardigan and admitting that they liked the Kinks and the Zombies. Whereas in punk, you could not admit that you liked any 60s band. It was like year one in 1977. You couldn't look back.
Jesus, don't want me for a Sunday.
Well, here's another distinction from punk and hip-hop. Both of those cultural movements got their names from musical genres, which is not the case with twee. Where did it get the name twee?
Well, the dictionary definition of twee, I mean, the word itself has been around for close to two centuries, certainly well over a century, and it's literally a form of mispronunciation of a child trying to say the word sweet. Over the years, it was used in everyday language, and then in the 80s, it was adopted by the British musical press to describe this youth movement. And now it's come to be mostly kind of a pejorative way of talking about a sort of post-hipster, urban, college-educated individual in, as we discussed, a negative way. And what I'm trying to do with my book is perhaps put it into a different context, see the difference between a lowercase t, twee, and a capital T, which has values that are admirable, you know, independence and a desire for a certain state of, I don't know, innocence, goodness, kindness.
Well, I can imagine, you know, sort of, isn't that tweet? That's doesn't sound so good. Is it any wonder that people that you had a hard time finding people who self-identify as twee?
It was a challenge to get some people to talk to me. I had to send out a letter or an email.
Well, I was going to say a letter would be really twee.
I'd actually written a letter. Yeah. you know, in the calligraphy script, "Dear sir, will you please, you know, phone me at this hour?" No, you know, where I had to sort of acknowledge that some people, quote unquote, felt that this was a pejorative word. But what I'm trying to do is tell a history in which time and again, this has been not only useful, but in its own way, sort of heroic. I mean, I feel like the another quality of twi that gets overlooked is that it is very anti-bullying.
Mm-hmm. So you're sort of trying to take twi back, like queer or something like that.
I'm not. It's not my cause or my mission, but it was certainly part of the balance that I was trying to achieve in the book. I mean, it's like Morrissey has that line, it's so easy to hate. Morrissey being the sort of
capital twee.
Yeah. Tweezus, you know. It takes guts to be gentle and kind. So that's kind of like the side I was trying to explore. But I tried to keep an objectivity. You know, I didn't want to give the people with the handlebar mustaches a free ride.
It's so easy to laugh, it's so easy to hate. It takes strength to be gentle and kind.
Well, you call twi in the subtitle of your book a gentle revolution. So what is Generation Twi revolting against?
I think the world is becoming, I don't know, less intimate, definitely scarier. The movement started to really pick up around, you know, like the end of the 90s and the election with Bush and Gore, and then obviously 9/11. And that sort of happened at the same time that social networking was going on and the rise of bloggers. And so maybe a lack of or a sense that our control was being taken away from us. I think that it's a reaction to that, which is why it's rooted so deeply in hands-on things like making an album, you know, in your bedroom and putting it up on your own website or YouTube diary and sharing that.
I'm speaking with the writer, journalist, and playwright Mark Spitz. His new book is called Twi, The Gentle Revolution in Music, Books, Television, Fashion, and Film. Now, Mark, you credit people like Walt Disney, and you mentioned characters like Holden Caulfield as being kind of the forefathers of twi. I'm wondering how far back you can go searching for the boundaries of a cultural movement without being revisionist. So what, for example, would stop you from saying Shakespeare was twi or Da Vinci?
Well, you know, I don't know how old Santa Claus is, but I think that he's twi. I hear what you're saying, and I just made a decision as the writer to start in the mid 20th century after World War II, but I believe that you could go probably back as far, if you wanted to Keats and Shelley and Wordsworth.
The Romantics.
The Romantics and the way that they sort of changed the nature of poetry to celebrating the self as opposed to religious imagery and sentiment, and did so at a time when there was violence all around, as there is today. But, you know, I didn't want to be too, I hate to say it, but precious about it, mm-hmm. you know. And you also, when you're dealing with the book, I knew I had to weave a lot into one sort of history because there are things that you can't leave out, even if, like, it would be more convenient to leave out, like, say, Garden State or something like that.
Mm-hmm. What are you listening to?
The Shins. You know them?
No.
You gotta hear this one song. It'll change your life, I swear. Oh, I'm sorry. You have to, you gotta fill out your forms. Conundrum.
I hear about your struggle with, you know, how to trace a movement without being pejorative and then lumping yourself in. I mean, I found myself asking if I am twi while I was discussing this segment with my colleagues, eating quinoa with hot almond milk and maple syrup that came from my friend's maple shack right. in Vermont. And I wonder, did you ask yourself the same? I mean, isn't twi a pretty broad brush?
Well, I think that it gets into everything, which makes it a genuine movement, whereas like hipster wasn't really a genuine movement, or emo, for example, before that. Whereas twee does sort of bleed into your breakfast, you know, in a way. And the book is sort of designed not as some kind of personality test or Rorschach test, but I knew that there would be people who would read it and say, wait a minute, you know, this is a little bit like a mirror. You know, I feel like I am reading a little bit about myself. Am I okay? Is that okay that I'm twee? And I think that you can be partially twee. You don't have to commit. You can be a weekend twee.
Well, it made me also wonder what is not twee, because a lot of the hipster characteristics we thought of sound to me to be twee.
I think the difference between twee and hipster is really simple. Those people wanted to be jaded and wanted you to think that they had been around the block more than they probably had, whereas twees want you to think that they've been around the block probably less than they probably have. And also hipsters were very fond of white belts for some reason.
Well, speaking of white, it seems to me a pretty white, educated, what, middle, upper middle class kind of movement. I was having trouble this morning coming up with somebody who is African-American who's twee. Maybe Andre 3000.
I think that there, you know, you could make arguments for early Prince in his sort of pre-Purple Rain new wave phase. You can make an argument for Donald Glover today, who was on Community up until recently. When Lana Dunham's show came out, there was that whole outcry over
the lack of minorities. She had no minority friends. In New York City, and then
she dealt with it head on by actually casting Donald Glover. There is certainly the need for diversity to strengthen any youth movement. Punk had people like Susie Sue fronting bands, which was kind of new, or bands like the Slits. They had people like Don Letts, who was key to the scene and kind of turned the white punks onto dub, which was very influential later on the Clash. And with hip hop, you had people like obviously Rick Rubin and the Beastie Boys. And in order for twee to continue to thrive, and it is here as a movement, so you'll need the equivalent.
Mark Spitz, I want to thank you for helping us navigate this fine line of twee.
Oh, you're welcome.
Mark Spitz is an author, playwright, and a journalist. His new book is called Twee, The Gentle Revolution in Music, Books, Television, Fashion, and Film. If you're feeling underconfident about what is twee, well, first of all, that is so twee, but you can find our handy cultural guide, What is Twee, at wordofmouthradio.org.
You're a part-time lover and a full-time friend. The monkey on your back is the latest trend. I don't see what anyone can see in anyone else but
I'll kiss you on the brain in the shadow of the train. Kiss you all starry-eyed.
So, badminton is twee, ping pong is twee, kickball is definitely twee. Soccer, twee or not? It certainly is beloved the world over. In fact, according to FIFA, nearly 700 million television viewers watched the 2010 World Cup final. Our next story isn't about soccer mania per se, but it is about loyalty and how a fan's view is shaped not by a team's lineup or players' abilities, but by its uniforms.
This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars. When it comes to sports, the uniforms matter a lot. The players come and go, they get traded, they retire, they leave via free agency, but you keep rooting for those colors and that logo and that uniform. And the measure of this, according to Paul Lucas, the creator of UniWatch, a website devoted to the obsessive study of athletics aesthetics, is this.
I'm a passionate New York Mets fan, and I really, really hate the New York Yankees. But if the entire Mets team, 25 guys, is traded even up for the entire Yankees team, 25 guys, today, who do I root for tomorrow? And to me, the answer is obvious. It's a no-brainer. I root for whoever is wearing the Mets uniform, no matter who it is, even if it's a bunch of guys who were wearing the Yankees uniform the day before.
There are certain things about a uniform that serve a purpose by being uniform. They help the players identify each other. They help us rally behind our team. They give us something cool to buy. But there are certain things on a uniform that aren't uniform.
The thing I'm particularly interested in or really obsessed with is the intersection of the pant leg and the sock, or basically the whole area below the knee. And it's the least legislated, least regulated, and really least uniform part of the uniform.
Even though baseball teams have been historically named after the color of their socks, there is no rule governing the length of the pants or whether or not you will actually see those socks.
Early baseball uniforms had essentially knickers. Those knickers started getting longer and longer, and now we have so many of the players who wear their pants all the way down to their shoe tops, like footy pajamas. And I think it's a shame or even a tragedy, because when you cover up the socks, you're basically dishonoring baseball's hosiery heritage.
Stirrup socks are the ultimate in baseball hosiery for the diehard old school fans. If you need help picturing a stirrup, they're basically two layers of sock. There's a bottom layer that's a normal old sock, but there's also an exterior sock that's a different color. But the bottom of that sock is just a strap that goes underneath the arch of the player's foot.
The idea behind stirrups goes back about a century. Baseball pants used to be just knickers, and you would wear stockings with them. Baseball was a pretty rough and tumble game. You would get cut in your stockings, and the fabric dyes in those days were not color fast. And so if you got spiked, dye from your stockings could get in the wound, and you could get blood poisoning, or so was the thinking. So someone got the idea that if you wore an undersock, you would have an extra layer of protection, a sanitary layer of protection. And so they didn't want you to have to wear the stocking over the undersock, because now you'd be wearing two pairs of socks and your shoes wouldn't fit anymore. And so they decided to create this little stirrup opening, and that's how baseball stirrups were born. And originally, that opening was tiny. It was just enough for your foot to fit through. And almost immediately, players began pulling it and stretching it higher. And by the 1960s, there were players who were actually adding more fabric to it so that they could pull their stirrups even higher, higher than the manufacturer had intended.
While stirrups may have had this functional origin, they quickly lost that, and they just became incorporated into the visual language of baseball.
And I think for many people, myself included, it's what we think of when we think of a baseball player.
But it seems that the romance is gone by the time you get to the big leagues.
I've asked players, why do you wear your pants down? And the answer I often get is, it's just so much less work. Now, there are other players who do hike their pants up high and just wear solid color socks and do so pretty nicely. Steven Strasburg of the Washington Nationals does something great called blousing, which means he doesn't just hike his pants up, but he tucks under the cuff in a way where it just sort of blouses out a little bit at the point where he tucks it under. And that's sort of a lost art, blousing. Jim Tomei, who recently retired, slugger who played for many teams, great, great blouser, all-time blouser. There are lots of little elements here to appreciate.
99% Invisible was produced this week by Jesse Thorne, with Sam Greenspan, Avery Truffleman, Katie Mingle, and me, Roman Mars. We are a project of KALW and distributed by PRX. More at 99pi.org.
Word of Mouth continues with a musical interlude. He's young, he's talented, and he's from the Upper Valley. Guitarist Michael Blum joins us in Studio D for a performance. That's after the break. Stay with us. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we're listening to Rebecca. It's one of the tracks from Michael Blum's debut album, Initiation. The 20-year-old guitarist from Hanover, New Hampshire, is hanging out his shingle in the jazz world and already getting good reviews for his melodic style and breezy improvisations. Michael Blum is going to be playing at the Canoe Club in Hanover on June the 15th and at the New Hampshire Bass Festival on June the 21st. That's at SNHU. Michael Blum, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here.
And also with us is the composer of that song, Rebecca, the bassist and educator, Jim Stennett.
Thank you very much.
Well, thanks for being here, both of you. But Michael, I have to start with you because you're 20 years old. You're a student at Dartmouth and didn't start as a music major at Dartmouth, did you?
I came into Dartmouth thinking that it would be a passion of mine. I never considered that it would be my major.
Which is?
It's technically a double major in cognitive science and music.
Okay, so how did that happen? How did the music, you made an album now, so music must have taken over some part of your passion.
Absolutely. I mean, I was raised in a musical home. Music was always a huge part of my life. I never thought it would be my career goal until my summer going into sophomore year, when I had an experience. I mean, it was technically my first experience working as a professional musician. I was working at the New London Barn Playhouse in New London, New Hampshire. And at the end of that summer, I decided I wanted to get serious. So I spoke to my father, who was initially trained as a musician, and he said, "You've got to meet my teacher." And so Jim happened to be in my hometown one day, and he was visiting my house. And I played some for him, and he said, "We're going to study for the next 2 years." And it scared me. But ever since, I've been studying very seriously with Jim. Mm-hmm. And
Jim, yeah. Jim, what did you hear on that first time you heard Michael play that made you think, yeah, this guy's
sure.
got it?
A lot of good things, but the main thing that, you know, sort of made me say, yeah, I'd like to teach this young man is he played a song that he had listened to and copied from a record by Jim Hall. And many students want to play like the master musicians, but most of them, quite frankly, won't go through the time and effort and the real work to make their playing sound like those people. And he played this song by Jim that Jim Hall had recorded, and it just sounded wonderful. And I recognized right then that not only did he have good talent, had ears and ability, but he was a hard worker. And quite frankly, that's what it's all about.
Jim Hall, famous, by the way, for playing Stella by Starlight was one of his big arrangements. So you guys did that for us live in the studio. Let's hear that. This is Michael Blum, who is playing here with Jim Stinnette, Stella by Starlight, the jazz standard. That's a jazz standard. You have some original compositions on this record, one that you wrote yourself. And I want to talk to you a little bit about composing music. I mean, you grew up in the era of indie rock, hip hop. I mean, how did jazz become the clear winner for you? And how do you approach a jazz composition?
That's a great question. I'll start with how I got introduced to jazz, and that's through my father. I remember very vividly driving through my hometown in his car and listening to one Jaco Pastorius album in particular. It's the one that's self-titled, Jaco. And that song, Come On, Come Over, it stuck with me for years. It's actually my ringtone these days. But anyway, it struck a chord with me, I guess.
So let's hear a little bit from one of your compositions, a very mournful but beautiful song. This is called 6 Weeks. Michael Blum on guitar and Jim Stinnette on bass. Jazz music, it has its ebbs and flows. There are a lot of people, great musicians working steadily still in jazz. But is there something that you feel that you bring to it in particular, or a way that you want to play that, I don't know, inspires you or in hopes to inspire others?
I think a big aspect of my playing and definitely my training from Jim and what sets it aside is that there is absolute respect to the jazz masters. I mean, all of my training from Jim has been centered around learning the language of some of my heroes, namely Grant Green, Wes Montgomery, Red Garland. And I think for those that know the language, that will be evident on my album.
Well, you're going to graduate Dartmouth's class of 2015.
That's correct.
a lot of your other classmates are going to be going on to very different careers.
Very true.
And yeah. I wonder about that, Jim. You know, you've obviously made an alternative choice in your life to pursue your art, your instrument.
Yeah.
While others are becoming investment bankers.
That's correct.
So any advice for your young protege?
Yes. And that is, you have to want it. As you just said, if your passion's enough, it's not easy over a lifetime, unless you happen to be sort of, quote, rich and famous. You have a hit as a musician, because you just described it exactly, while others are doing other things. But the joy of just playing music and affecting other people, because after a while, after you get through wiggling your fingers and working on that, it's really all about sharing and communicating with other people. And it has to be worth it to you. And if it is, it's not a problem.
Well, congratulations to you, Michael Blum.
Thank you so much.
On a great record. And Jim Stinnett, thank you so much for joining us.
I'm very proud of this young man, and it's obvious.
And, well, you should be.
Thank you.
Well, we'll leave you with the good reason for that pride. This is Michael Blum playing with Jim Stinnett. The song is Castle Rock. Michael Blum is a jazz guitarist based in Hanover, New Hampshire. His new album, Initiation, is out now. And you can see him for yourself on June the 15th at the Canoe Club in Hanover, and on June 21st at the New Hampshire Bass Festival at SNHU. The full quartet will be with him. You can also see a video of Michael and Jim playing live in our studio and find a link to hear more songs from the record Initiation. All the links at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. To quote another jazz standard, it's nice work if you can get it. But what if that work required you to be the only naked person in a room full of clothed people? Sound like a nightmare? Well, for Buck Dietz, it's a dream. Buck is a figure model. He's been sketched or painted by countless artists who frequent the surprising number of life drawing classes on Cape Cod, especially in the summer. Andrew Norton wanted to find out what goes through the mind of the naked object in the center of the room.
Buck Dietz likes to find his poses from silent films. So that means when he's watching Charlie Chaplin and he sees something he likes, he'll pause it, get in that position, and then quickly sketch it down. Posing is more than just standing still for him.
I'd like to think when I pose, I'm acting. It's not as simple as just standing there. If there's a story behind it, I think it can motivate people and inspire them.
He flips through a stack of old papers packed with his sketches. Rough drawings of bodies in different positions. Buck is a figure model. He poses naked for artists. And these are like his set lists.
Names, like this one is called 76 Trombones, Neptune, Saint Sebastian. I got some religious stuff there, obviously.
Those names he gives his poses, they're more than names. They're cues.
My Elvis pose.
They get him into character. And Buck might need to bust out dozens of them for a single modeling session. Some artists can even demand up to 50.
Do you have like a greatest hit?
Yeah, there's one that I have. I always leave it for the 10th pose, the final pose. And I actually call it Showstopper because I'm standing on my head.
Today, Buck is posing for a class in Barnstable, right side up.
Well, we're in the restroom at Cape Cod Art Association, and they're really nice bathrooms here. They're very clean. Removing my underwear, which is important.
Buck puts on a robe and sandals and heads to class. For this session, he has to hold completely still for 3 hours, only breaking every 20 minutes. But he'll stare at the same spot on the floor, without talking, without shifting, without doing anything. Just one pose.
Stand perfectly still for 20 minutes, and then get back in touch with me. And let me know how that felt. Let me know if you could even accomplish that. Most people can't. It requires an enormous amount of concentration, and double that.
Hello, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm fine.
In the studio, a handful of artists set up their easels. Buck takes a seat at the table, and you quickly forget that he's naked. Legs spread, hands on either side of him, head turned, and completely still. So still that Buck says it doesn't take long for the pain to set in. And he has a few ways of dealing with the cramps and the aches. His main method, the one he swears by, show tunes.
I will start with the letter A. I'll pick any show that begins with A. Let's say Annie. I will take one song from that show, Annie, tomorrow, let's say. And I will, in my mind, go through that whole song.
You're always a day away.
Then I'll move on to B. Bells are ringing. Then I'll get to C. Carousel. Oh, great. Okay, I know by the time I finish this song, my 20 minutes will be up. I know it sounds very bizarre, but it does work for me.
This mental trick helps pass the time while he models and puts him in a sort of meditation.
My idea of heaven is to be totally nude while singing songs from the Great American Songbook.
Yes, love.
Buck's trained as a performer, but to keep still, he's had to hone his technique over the past 5 years. And before moving to the Cape, he wasn't always so willing to put himself out there like he does now.
I always hated that moment after, you know, P.E., you'd have to take a shower. I never wanted to take my clothes off from when I was a kid. And as I got older, I guess, I certainly have changed my tune. Now you can't keep the clothes on me.
The long class is wrapping up, and only a few artists are left to finish their drawings. Buck is quiet and still, holding his pose until the last few minutes. But in his head, he's halfway through the Great American Songbook.
This is how the time goes.
The session ends and Buck comes back to life.
Thank you.
See you in a couple weeks.
Every easel has a different take on his pose.
When you're looking at the drawings and when you're kind of seeing people's work, do people ever see things in you that you don't see?
Yeah, I think a certain stillness, because I think I'm high energy, but there's something really beautiful about being still, which I don't think I ever appreciated until I started figure modeling.
For WCAI's Creative Life, I'm Andrew Norton.
Word of Mouth continues with another profession that requires you to bear it all, stand-up comedy. Todd Glass has been in the business for decades and shared stages with the likes of Jerry Seinfeld and Sarah Silverman. But his biggest reveal was coming out as gay on a popular comedy podcast. We're going to talk with him about hiding his true identity in a business that thrives on ruthless honesty. A conversation with Todd Glass after the break.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Sarah Silverman considers him one of her favorite comedians of all time. Jim Gaffigan said he is the funniest person he knows, and Patton Oswalt describes him as a human hurricane and comedic force of nature. Although he's been performing stand-up since 1982, Todd Glass made his boldest move in the business when he came out publicly as gay on comedian Mark Maron's podcast WTF in January of 2012.
What's up, Todd?
How you doing?
No, I just wanted to come on and promote my podcast.
Oh, shit.
Glass Show.
I had no idea that's what we were doing.
Oh, yeah. What did you think?
Oh, I thought you were gay.
Oh, are you shitting me?
Yeah, is that weird?
Oh, my God.
I'm sorry.
Oh, my God. Did you really think that?
Yeah.
Why?
Because we had these phone calls.
All right, let's cut the shit here. Yeah.
A year and a half has passed since that groundbreaking moment, and Todd Glass writes about it in his new book, The Todd Glass Situation, A Bunch of Lies About My Personal Life and a Bunch of True Stories About My 30-Year Career in Stand-Up Comedy. Todd Glass, thrilled to have you with us on Word of Mouth.
It's good to be here.
At the beginning of this book, you write about suffering a heart attack. You're backstage at a comedy club. You were 45 years old then. You tried to fix yourself by quitting smoking and losing weight. You actually waited 2 years to come out publicly. So what, if not that, finally drove you to do it?
Well, you would think that the heart attack did it, but, you know, I thought it would. You know, I realized when the heart attack happened, I thought 2 days afterwards I would start being much more honest in a quicker way, not one a year telling people. When I was in the ambulance, I yelled out to Sarah Silverman because I knew she had to call the person I had been in a relationship with for a long time, but I didn't want to say a guy's name. So I yelled out and I went, Sarah, call Andrea. Andrea. And she knew Andrea was code for Chris. Mm-hmm. And I remember there, even laying there while having a heart attack going, this is so pathetic. It's so pathetic. Even a little bit laughing at myself because, you know, if it's pathetic, it can sometimes be funny, especially if you're aware of it. And I went, what am I doing? And then it took me about a year and a half after that to finally go, okay, it's time to like just be honest about who I am. And of course, life, I didn't know it would get better, but it got better. It did get much better. It's like that weight off the shoulders. You think you know what that means. You're like, oh yeah, weight off your shoulders. You have something on your mind. You get it off. And it's, but once it happens, it's like, oh my God, this feels so much better.
Mark writes the introduction to your new book and says he didn't suspect at all. I mean, he had no idea. And many people didn't. You told a handful of people, maybe 15 people, your family, your close friends. Nobody suspected.
Well, my close friends knew, you know, like even if I didn't tell them, but people around me all the time, like a lot of comedians, I know they were, and they didn't care. And I think there's a lot of people from a loving place that might say something like from a loving place, but also confused, like, what, why is he hide it? Nobody cares. Mm. Know that a lot of those people, including me, knew that inwardly, but we didn't start hiding today. For me, it started when I was 13 years old, and then the lie perpetuates and perpetuates, and at one point, you get comfortable in the lie.
Mm. In your act, you even fabricated a girlfriend. Here's a clip of one of your jokes. This is from the 2008 Just for Laughs Gala in Montreal.
My neighbor smells. My girlfriend wants me to tell him he smells, but I don't want to hurt his feelings. She goes, tell him creatively. And how is that? What do you say creatively? You go, hey, is your ass backed up? Chew the nail. Now your ass isn't backed up. It's cool. Are you sure? No?
So aside from the fake girlfriend, how authentic was that? Was it drawn from a real experience?
So I love the way you asked that question, because most people just say to me in interviews, oh, that's so sad that you had to make up a girlfriend and make up a story. And I go, whoa, I made up that it was a girl, but I didn't make up the story, which indirectly prove something, which I never thought I was out proving it, but I did. You know, people wonder, what is the difference between same-sex relationships versus, guy-girl, guy-guy? What's the difference, you know? There is no difference, because every time I told those stories on stage, I was in a relationship with a guy. But when I switched it and told it to audiences, never once did they go, that's weird, because it's the same exact thing. The only way the audience would have figured it out that was different if I said, I was in the bathroom at the airport and I was going to the bathroom next to my girlfriend. And they'd be like, wait a second, what airport bathroom does this guy use?
Well, I guess reading your book, I really enjoyed reading about your early life. I wanted to say you moved, I think, 5 times in 8 years, or maybe 8 times in 5 years. I may have that
mixed up. Yeah, we moved a lot.
But that gave me some perspective on the outsider. You were dyslexic, ADHD. You were Jewish in these predominantly WASPy neighborhoods, and gay. So you must have grown up thinking, wow, I'm just out of it on all counts.
You know what? I don't want to make it look like woe is me, because I had a really good life. My parents were awesome. My people that surrounded me. I'm not trying to get up on a podium, and because I do a lot of wrong things in my life and I make a lot of mistakes. But where I try to be decent, I guess it comes from sitting around so long and hearing people not say anything. And we lived in a neighborhood where I would hear people make like sort of homophobic comments, and they weren't egregious. They weren't like F this group or F that group. They were like things at a dinner table or at a Thanksgiving dinner table, and nobody said anything.
But you said a lot when you were growing up, apparently, talking all the time, entertaining your teachers, started performing stand-up in high school. Was there a moment when you thought, I'm going to be a comedian, that's it?
Well, comedy for me, and I like all types of comedy, like some silly comedy growing up, hearing Steve Martin did it for me, but I also like comedy that is social, he has something to say, or politically. And for comedians, that was what I understood. When George Carlin talked about it, I got it. So I always really loved stand-up comedy. And then when I was in high school, we started going to this club. Now, a lot of the guys like that I'll mention now, they weren't as famous as they are now. But we would go see people at this place called the Comedy Works. We'd see like Jerry Seinfeld, Gary Shandling, Paul Reiser, Jay Leno, Jerry Seinfeld, you know, Richard Lewis, Gilbert Godfrey. The list would just go Stephen Wright, Eddie Murphy, Roseanne Barr. So I saw a lot of really good comedy, and I loved it. I mean, I didn't just like it. I'm not exaggerating, fell in love with stand-up comedy. I went every single week, and then I heard those infamous words. Hey, if you think you're funny, Wednesday night's open mic night. And there it all started.
I'm speaking with the stand-up comedian Todd Glass. He's been in the business for more than 30 years and regularly appears on shows like Jimmy Kimmel Live. In 2012, he shook the comedy world when he came out publicly as gay on the WTF podcast. We're talking with him about his new book, The Todd Glass Situation. Stand-up comedy requires risk-taking. You deal with hecklers and rejection and instability of life on the road. On top of that, you started comedy in the early 80s. Now, this is right when the AIDS crisis hit the U.S. Homophobia and misinformation about how it was spread was just rampant at that time. How did you deal with that in your circles, both on stage and off?
You know, that's why I'm very careful in the jokes that I make today. You know, in comedy, I think a lot of times when I speak about comedy, some people misunderstand me. And I hope this leads back to answering your question, which I think it will. As far as, like, you don't want to offend people. Look, you have to offend people. You just hope you're offending the right people. But back then, there were a lot of jokes about just, you know, about AIDS and about, you know, can you imagine two guys? And, man, it did not help. Plus, the way people threw around the word, you know, gay, gay, faggot, gay, and all instead of saying lame. So then you have to say to yourself later, like, I have to come out, and a word that I've heard used as lame for 25 years, think just lame, lame, gay, gay, gay. Now you have to tell people I'm gay. So, you know, yeah, back then it was very scary to, as a comedian, it did not lead a path for me to come out. So again, going back to your original question, you know, like, that's why it was hard, you know, when a lot of people go, what's he afraid of? Hey, go back to 1982. That's where I started, you know, really being in the closet. Mm-hmm.
And being backstage with people and having conversations about, would you drink out of the same glass as a gay person drank out of?
Yeah. And by the way, that conversation was not from a bunch of morons. That was, I remember hearing those conversations, and it was from pretty evolved people that were confused about it. Hey, they had to have the conversation, but I heard that. And that really went, oh, my God, like, that really penetrated. And it really made me, you know, just say, OK, this is not something I want to share with anybody.
Well, here's one of your friends and a very evolved person, Louis C.K. This is from a 2008 routine. Just want to warn listeners that he does use some of those barbed words we were just speaking to Todd about.
I miss that word. You know, I grew up saying that word. And it never meant gay. When I was a kid, I don't know what gay was. No, I hadn't been told that people do that. I had no f***ing idea. Faggot didn't mean gay. When I was a kid, you called somebody faggot because they're being a faggot, you know?
Louis C.K. from his 2008 stand-up special called Chewed Up. Listening to that clip from Louis C.K., now you admit that even you have a hard time saying the word gay. Why is that?
Yeah, well, I'm a very big Louis C.K. fan, and I understand what he's saying about that joke, and I don't know if I totally disagree with it. It's where you take it from that point on. I think when some people hear that joke, they might misunderstand that he's saying it's okay to use it, and I'm not sure exactly what he's saying, but when somebody uses a word as an adjective, like, you know, someone's being is an adjective, it's that simple. Instead of saying clumsy, some people say retarded, and you're like, no, just use the adjective. Don't make someone's being a negative adjective. You have to see how that's bad. I don't think they did anything wrong. And it's a funny way I'm saying it, but it'll make a twist. Nobody using the word gay as an adjective did anything wrong at all. But once someone makes you privy to that word does have a path to causing someone pain, you didn't think it did. That's why you didn't do anything wrong. But now once someone makes you aware of it, yeah, I was a 12-year-old kid. And if you have your headphones on or you're listening to this interview right now and you can't say to yourself, oh, I guess that would suck that your being meant lame. That your being, and I'm repeating it, meant lame. If you can't go inward and go, oh, I didn't know it and I didn't do anything wrong, but now I do know it and I choose to keep using that word, I really do wonder about that person, because I don't know how to rattle you out of saying that word. You know, if what I just said doesn't make you go, oh, that makes total sense, I'm going to stop that.
Some of the best comedy does require rigorous, unguarded honesty. I think about Richard Pryor, you know, joking about setting himself on fire while freebasing cocaine, or Louis C.K. talking about raising kids as a single parent. Now, do you think remaining closeted kept you from being truly funny? And in other words, was there a part of you censoring yourself?
At first, I thought it didn't. I thought, well, I'm not honest about my relationships, but I am honest about so many other things, and I don't talk about relationships that much. But then afterwards, I realized, yes, it did, because I would keep anything out of my act that wasn't perceived to be manly. I like lighting a certain way when I go into a room. I don't like it light. I like it dark. I don't like cooking because I don't have the patience, but I like the look of a set table. I like the look of when you're having a big dinner and there's like 15 people and it's set. I set the table the night before. I used to be afraid to talk about that on stage because I thought, well, that doesn't seem manly. So maybe, hey, look, I'll be confident. Maybe I was a good comic, but I can take it to another level now. You know, the more honest you are on stage, yes, obviously, that's what makes a better comic.
Well, Todd Glass, what a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
You know what? It was a very enjoyable conversation. I appreciate you having me on.
Todd Glass's new book is called The Todd Glass Situation, a bunch of lies about my personal life and a bunch of true stories about my 30-year career in stand-up comedy. For those who'd like to hear more from Todd, you can find a link to his podcast. It's called The Todd Glass Show, and we've got a link at wordofmouthradio.org. You may have heard earlier in the show when we spoke with journalist Mark Spitz about his book, Twee. We were trying to find out why this nostalgia for innocence and purity is thriving and why it's being embraced by all of America now. So while there are certainly some things that are undeniably twee, you know, think DIY crafts or adult kickball leagues, other things are a little bit more difficult to categorize. So after the interview, we decided to put Mark to the test and throw some New Hampshire-specific items and activities to figure out exactly how twee is our very own state. Kayaking, is that twee?
I don't think kayaking is twee. I would say not twee.
How about snowshoeing?
It's definitely more twee if you were wearing like an outfit that made you look like a Charlie Brown character.
Okay, how about Game of Thrones, the television series?
I've never seen it. My gut is that it's not very twee.
Okay, how about Bitcoin?
Definitely not twee.
Okay, maple syrup.
Yeah, sure. Pancakes are very twee, so you got to put the maple syrup on it, and then you've got the perfect twee breakfast.
How about basketball?
Twee sports, I'm thinking more like badminton, things like that, you know, croquet. I would say not twee.
All right, flannel shirts.
Twee-ish. You know, Kurt Cobain is in my book and was very twee in his own way, and I explain why and how. So let's say maybe.
All right, how about fleece?
This is personal that I have, you know, no offense to people who wear fleece, and I know it gets very cold in New Hampshire, but I would say not twee.
All right, how about iPhones?
Twee, yeah. Anything Apple, anything Jobsian is twee.
All right, bowling. Yeah. Oh, we already went through sports. Is bowling twee?
I would say bowling is twee.
All right.
I would say if you have a nice iridescent, you know, or sort of marbleized vintage ball.
Motorcycles.
Yeah, but you have to have the Zach Braff Garden State sidecar on them.
Okay. Woody Allen, is he twee?
You can make an argument that he is sort of the archetype for the kind of skinny, bespectacled, modern twee boy figure. So, yes.
Barack Obama.
Certainly more so than W.
All right, we're going to stay with personalities. Beyonce.
I would say no.
Jay-Z.
No.
Okay, how about Solange? Does well, this go into the whole anti-bullying
indie, she's
thing?
She's more indie rock, and apparently she's definitely got some roiling emotion going on. So I would say, yeah, why not?
Okay, how about YouTube?
Yes, very twee.
All right, and since we mentioned it at the beginning, Anne Frank.
Yes, but mostly in a literary way,
mm-hmm.
Because of the fact that she was obviously, you know, horribly repressed, but still writing this beautiful work. I think that that was inspirational and twee, and she is obviously a powerful symbol today and has inspired bands like Neutromilk Hotel, who made that album, a concept album about her in The Airplane Over the Sea, which mm-hmm. is very twee in and of itself. So I would say yes.
Thank you so much for on-the-spot rulings on some pretty difficult questions.
the syrup was the tricky one.
If you'd like to see a full list of what is to be twee and not to be twee, visit our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And for the record, public radio is very, very twee. Thanks so much for joining us today. If you like what you heard, there's much more to listen to and to share at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us and send us your feedback or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. I'm Virginia Prescott. Have a great weekend. My colleague Taylor Quimby is going to be hosting on Monday at 2 when Word of Mouth returns, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.